Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 340 of the podcast. It's Thursday, 21st of September, 2017. As I record this a little early, as I am heading off to Scotland this weekend to speak at the Society of Authors Scots Write event. And I'm speaking on marketing and also how to make a living with your writing. So I'll report back on that next week. Today, I'm talking with Ricardo Fayette from Readzy about the top mistakes that authors make. Readzy is a fantastic marketplace to find vetted editors, cover designers, and marketing professionals. So Ricardo sees a lot of authors in the community. He's also French, so you will enjoy his accent. Okay, in publishing this week, I actually haven't been following too much publishing news. I've been super busy. I did see that Audible has launched a Canada-specific site. So Canadians could get Audible subscriptions before, but now they have a specific site for Canada. So that bodes well, you know, as audiobooks continue. And obviously last week we announced Kobo getting into audiobooks. So yeah, I think it's, you know, more and more evidence that audiobooks are continuing to grow. So this week, as I said, I was busy. I actually attended the IPG, the Independent Publishers Guild in the UK, autumn conference up in London. Because I have a small press, Curl Up Press, and I make a specific amount of revenue from book sales, I can be seen as a publisher as well as an author. And what's funny is I basically have I have three business cards now. One for Curl Up Press, one for the Creative Pen, and one for JF Pen. And depending on who I'm talking to at the time and what they're interested in, I kind of have to give people different cards. So that's quite funny. But what's interesting, and the reason I joined the IPG is because, you know, I learn a lot from authors in the community about writing, about craft, about marketing as authors, but mainly, let's face it, we are focused on ebooks. You know, we do look at print and audio, but learning about print publishing is very interesting. Also, seeing behind the curtain or behind the veil about the publishing industry, very interesting. So I went as Joanna Penn from Curl Up Press. And there were a number of things, and I'm going to share a number of things that I learned, but kind of my first overarching feeling was, you know, we focus on a specific area, and they had presentations on print on demand from Ingram, and I'll be talking about Ingram Spark a bit later, but it was a discussion on print on demand as if this was a new thing. And that surprised me because obviously indies have been using print on demand for years. They also had talks on getting on the radio and even a session on reaching print newspaper bookstore audiences. So I felt, you know, that was, these are places that we often consider, you know, not that effective in selling ebooks, but obviously this was a print focused audience. So some of my thoughts on the day that are specifically useful to you, or hopefully, or that I found interesting, so I thought I would share. One is that the whole day was business and product focused, not author or craft focused. So comparing that to the Society of Authors, where I'm, you know, going this weekend, that whole conference is for authors and has craft. It has some business stuff, but it's mainly, you know, on the writing side. And when I go to conferences with authors, or even the audience of this podcast, for example, most people do not make a living from book sales only. But in the room, there were over 300 people who all make their living from specifically book sales and doing things with their intellectual property rights. So that is a very different group of people. And it was very much more focused on the business side of publishing. And the word author was barely mentioned at all, to be honest. So it was really good to start learning from a different side of the industry. And the conversations I had were about distribution, marketing, business, even things like who owns the company. This is something I'm fascinated with, and I'll come back to in a minute. Secondly, a reminder that you can make money in a very narrow niche. So, for example, the History Press was there, and they're a very successful imprint, you know, dealing in history books specifically. There was a guy there specializing in books about trains, another for engineering textbooks. And, you know, we get so focused on the mainstream ebook genres, I think, that we forget the incredible power of a voracious community in a smaller niche, and especially with print books. So a good example of this is Joseph Alexander, who's a seven-figure indie who has books on learning how to play the guitar. And I'm actually interviewing him next week, and he'll be on the show in October. And he has print books in a very small niche, but makes very good money. And I felt that at the IPG as well. There are people there who are just focused on one area, and in that way, they reach a voracious community who we might not generally look at. So another kind of reason for you to don't necessarily listen to the you must be in a mainstream big niche to make money. Think about the tiny niches and, have a look there. The next thing was about book covers and the appeal of book covers to independent booksellers. So they were talking about the difference between big box and supermarket sales. So having a cover that suits the buyer of books at Walmart or in Britain, Tesco's, for example, is very different to the person who runs their own bookstore who buys books because they like the look and feel. So the sort of mass market, they actually use thrillers as an example, which is funny because obviously I write thrillers. They said, you know, the cover of a mass market thriller is not something that they potentially would stock in an independent bookstore, but they would be interested in a beautiful cover that, for a French translation, for example. They, and the type of readers who shop at independent bookstores, they talked about having an email list, they do events. Very different model to the one that most indies do. Also, they said that personalized contact with booksellers does work. So identify the independent store where your book might sell. Get in, make sure you understand the leanings of that store, and then a personal touch as to why your book specifically will be suitable for their audience, really thinking about it. And this is a good tip for pitching in general, whether it's media or podcasts or bookstores or whatever, is really identifying the audience of the place and having something that's very targeted to that. And then the other thing that I found really interesting was the business models of the publishers and how many had either been bought by bigger publishers, so had been set up as an independent company and then had been bought later on, and those intellectual property rights have gone to a different house as another imprint. There were publishers there who've moved imprint, moved houses a number of times. There were companies there whose kind of aim was to sell their business to a larger publisher. And so I want, from the author perspective, this is really interesting. I mean, a typical startup company does want to sell. And we've had this in Britain recently with Bookature, which became sort of the biggest and most successful digital only publisher that then got bought by Hachette UK. And what was interesting was the difference between me and many of you, most of you I would expect, as indies, which is I'm writing because I love writing first. Yeah, it'd be nice to make some money, but I'm not going, I've actually had an offer for the Creative Pen. And it's weird because if you remove me from the Creative Pen, then it's not the Creative Pen anymore. So this is the thing. There's a business model which is based around a personal brand of a person. And then there's a company that's designed to sell to a bigger company, like something like Bookature, which was not built around a specific person. So this is something to consider. If you are looking for a publisher, so I actually talked to someone, and I can't mention names and things, but I talked to someone at an imprint which I've been interested in myself in pitching and learned about their ownership structure. And this is fascinating. Who owns the company you are interested in submitting your work to? You can just go on Google. If it's a published, a publicly listed company, you can find that information quite easily, but you can dig down into the sort of, you know, the information on someone's website to find what's going on. You know, often a company will be owned by another company. So a big brand like HarperCollins, which will own a lot of small imprints, is ultimately owned by News Corp, which is part of the Murdoch empire. And if you look at that, you know, that might go against some of your, some people's ethics, or it might be something you want to do because it's so big versus licensing your rights to a small company who might care a lot at the beginning, but in 3 years' time, they might sell to another company. And that's when authors can get orphaned as such, and your favorite editor might not go with that company or something like that. So this is something I find many authors don't think too much about. But if you are looking to get a traditional publishing deal, have a look at, you know, behind the scene, what is the business model of this publisher? You know, is it, you know, just have a look at it because it's so fascinating. So I'm diving down into this in a lot more detail these days. Even I was looking at the Bloomsbury share price, which Bloomsbury is who publishes J.K. Rowling in the UK, not her ebooks because she kept her ebook rights, but her print. So they have print Harry Potter. And basically, if you want a cut of J.K. Rowling's income, you could buy shares in Bloomsbury. So, but I was having a look at it and, you know, some of the other publishers who are publicly listed, and this is just interesting stuff that I'm sort of digging into, whether or not you care that's up to you, but it is a good thing to kind of change heads from author to publisher sometimes, and hopefully that will give you some ideas. There were also some completely separately, some interesting futurist things this week. So, you know, sometimes I have a bit of a segment in my intro on futurist things. And I've stated before that I think translation is going to be disrupted, and that within, let's say, 5 to 10 years, translation by AIs will mean we can read foreign language books through our devices. So I can download an app or whatever it will be, put on the glasses as such or contact lenses, and I will be able to pick up a book in Mandarin, and I'll be able to read it in English without there having to be a translation. Now, this would disrupt the translation market for books as well as everything else. It's one of these big disruptive technologies. And obviously, like print, like everything else, there will be high-end human translation for literary fiction, poetry, and special editions, but mass-market books will be AI translated and thus a lot cheaper. Similar to audiobooks, most likely, there will still be high-end human readings, and then there will be the mass-market AI-read books. But this is now a step closer back on the translation. Two things, iOS 11 was announced this week by Apple, and Siri has a new feature, which is the ability to translate phrases into a number of different languages. So if you say to Siri, how do you say I'd like a beer in German, Siri will answer if you're on the internet. So this is really interesting because, you know, Skype has a translation thing going, Siri now has one. And then, even more fascinating, there was an article on the Google blog, which is a really interesting blog if you're interested in futurist stuff. So just at blog.google, on how publishers can take advantage of machine learning. So what it says is, as publications expand their reach into more countries, they have to write for multiple audiences in different languages, and many cannot afford multi-language desks. Google Cloud Translation makes translating for different audiences easier by providing a simple interface to translate content into more than 100 languages. Vice magazine launched Google Fish earlier this year to help editors quickly translate articles. And DB Corp, India's largest newspaper group, publishes 62 editions in 4 languages and uses Google Cloud Translation to capture and document interviews with accuracy rates of 95% for Hindi alone. So this is fascinating to me because we are all, you know, Google Cloud translation. If you think we're all original and our opinions are original, but within each culture, our language, within each language, you know, there's only a certain number, a finite number of word combinations. Well, maybe there isn't a finite number, but as, you know, as these AIs learn this stuff, so, you know, the Google Cloud translation tool, I think, is something that you might have an overlay in the future for the what I expect to be Google contact lenses or something like that, that I can wear and be able to read in different languages. I think that is very, very cool. And as I've said before, I'm very positive about the future. I think generally people come down on the side of good. So I'm with Kevin Kelly, who wrote The Inevitable and Wired magazine, and, you know, started that. And, you know, humanity ticks over into the good more than the bad, and that we will use AI as a tool. So I fully intend to use AI as a tool as soon as I can. So really interesting. And then finally, on futurist stuff, also on the Google blog, because I was over there reading, Google has announced a mobile payment and e-commerce app made specifically for India first, called Tez, T-E-Z. Says, with more than 300 million smartphone users and rapidly improving connectivity in India, we wanted to build a product that can compete with cash to make digital payments truly work. And India has a very a huge focus on the digital economy because they want to move people off cash, basically. It needs to be simple, affordable, work everywhere for everyone. So today in India, we're introducing a new mobile app, Tez, a simple and secure way to pay for things, big and small, online and offline, built on top of the country's unified payments interface standard. So this, to me, is, you know, I think India is going to be first in this micropayment, you know, very digital economy, because they have such a big population and a growing middle class and more internet. It's so fascinating. So again, you know, lots of people investing in India in terms of a market, lots of English speaking Indians, although of course with the with the translation tool it might not be a problem, but yes, I'm very excited about this. I think it means that as more you know, more people in India discover ebooks and can potentially buy using devices like this, this is very cool. So there you go. There's some futurist stuff that I've been looking at this week. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Thanks to all of you who offered advice on how I could take 6 to 8 weeks off. I appreciate your kind words. And this is the thing, you know, I would, like many of us, I oscillate between, oh, but, you know, I don't want to step away for that long. But, you know, also, I really would like to do the Camino de Santiago. So I think probably my aim will be to do it before I'm 45, which is in a couple of years' time. So we shall see. Randy Green says, I greatly enjoy listening to your podcast while I ride on public buses in the world's largest city, Chongqing, China. I might have massacred that, sorry. Quite an unlikely lifestyle for an American who never planned or prepared consciously for living in China. That's fantastic. And China is another really fascinating place that I want to go to and haven't yet. But yeah, really interesting. Amy Cesari says, listening on the 1 year anniversary of getting sacked from my corporate gig, I'm free, I'm an author. Fantastic. And a very positive spin on getting sacked or, you know, changes in the economy. Michael Kowal, listening to your awesome podcast with Sarah Painter in far west Outer Mongolia. In the background are the Altai Mountains, a couple of jers or yurts in neighbouring yards, and in front of the mud brick fence, 10 tons of coal for the winter as it gets down to minus 40. Yes, so Outer Mongolia, I really, that is not on my list, to be fair. Terry Connellan says, listening to the show with Ros Morris, really enjoyed, the chat on writing memoir this week was awesome. Thank you, Terry. Sally Stevenson in New Zealand, listening to the show while celebrating my book's release and it charted on the LGBT sci-fi list. Thanks for all the advice. Congrats on your launch, Sally. That's fantastic. Eileen Amosa says, binge listening to the show until my co-driver liked the message on a 1,300 kilometre drive trip to visit friends. Well done, Eileen. And finally, L.E. Vera says, listening to the latest episode while waiting for my driving test definitely made me relax. Well, I hope you passed, L.E. And if you didn't, don't worry, you can always retake it. So today's show is sponsored by Ingram Spark, a new sponsor for the show and one I am very happy to introduce. I use Ingram Spark to print and distribute my self-published print books because with Ingram Spark, it's my content, but they help me do more with it. So the main reason to use Ingram Spark alongside CreateSpace is for the extended distribution for your print on demand books. You can have access to 39,000 retailers, which include independent bookstores, libraries, schools and universities, chain bookstores and more across a global network of distributors. These are people, as I talked before about the independent booksellers, these are people who are not going to order from Amazon because you can't get a discount on a book when you order it on Amazon. So you need to be in the catalogues that the booksellers and universities, etc., access and offer a discount to make your books more attractive, which you can do through Ingram. You can choose to use returns, but personally, I don't do that. And I've never had an issue. Since I started to use Ingram in January 2017, I have grown my print revenue streams. And I guess excitingly, because I haven't specifically targeted print bookstores, but I speak at a number of literary festivals. And the first time this year, the In Festival bookstore has been able to order my books, which has been brilliant for marketing and for standing on an equal footing with traditionally published authors speaking at the same festivals. So basically, if you know that there's always a bookstore who's responsible for the literary festival, and if they can't find your book with a discount in their catalogue, they won't order it. So I think, you know, that's a really good reason to be on Ingram Spark. If you're a speaker and you have or you have a physical distribution option yourself, you can get books at a much cheaper price and you can print locally. So when I spoke, well, locally, depending on where you are. So, for example, they have printing service in Australia. And when I spoke in Australia earlier this year, I had my books printed over there and it was a lot cheaper. So that is fantastic, too. So if you want to do more with your print books, head over to ingramspark.com. Right, and this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a huge thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, which is a hugely important part of my, my revenue these days and something I value highly. Thanks to new patron, Elle Lahois, and I might have got this totally wrong. Sorry, Elle. Elle Lahois, and thanks also to Taryn Blackthorne for increasing her pledge. I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It really demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue onward to 400 and maybe even 500 episodes one day. So on Patreon, you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you like, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I sent out last week. If you're on Patreon or you join, you will get all the backlist of Q&A shows. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here with Ricardo Fayette. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi, Joanna. So happy to be here.
Yes, great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Ricardo is an entrepreneur and the co-founder of Readzy, a marketplace for writers to find vetted professionals for editing, marketing, design, ghostwriters, and more. And it's a fantastic service, and we'll be talking about that. But Ricardo, start by telling us a bit more about you, why you have such a lovely accent, and how you got into this entrepreneurial space in publishing.
Well, so as you mentioned, I'm one of the founders of Readzy, the lovely accent. Thank you for saying that. It's a mix of French, Spanish, sometimes Italian. It depends on my mood. And it's due to a mixed European background, basically. And now how I got into publishing, it's a bit of a long story. It was with a friend of mine, Emmanuel, who's a co-founder, and were very early adopters of the e-reading format. So he imported his, lived in France, and he imported his Kindle from across the States because they weren't selling them in France back then. And I was one of the first people to read on the iBooks app. So I'm one of these weird people who read on their phone, all their books, I know. And he started thinking about what this meant for publishing in general, for authors, for publishers, for agents. So he started learning about self-publishing, and he told me about it. And one of the questions we had is, if you self-publish, I mean, writing is only a part of it. So who does the editing? Who does the design? And so we came up with the idea behind Readsy, and we jumped right into it. And here we are 2-3 years later, pretty happy about it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like you mentioned, you're mixed European and Emmanuel is as well. And he's actually coming on the show to talk about futurist stuff, which is going to be cool in November. But, you know, one of the interesting things about France, especially, I think, is that it's not an early adopter culture technologically. So how do you feel like, you know, the entrepreneurial space we often hear coming out of America versus Europe? So what are your kind of international perspectives on this kind of thing?
France got a bad reputation, really, yeah? We're going to change that. No, it's true. I mean, in France is very traditional, and the people who stay in France are very traditional. We moved to the UK. There's a lot of French people with startups in the US. I mean, there's a huge French startup ecosystem. The only thing is it's not necessarily in France, though it's developing in France right now with the new president. I think there are a lot of good things going on. It's a lot easier to raise funds right now for startups in France than it was when we started out, so 2-3 years ago. So things are changing. Now, on the early adopter side of things, it's true that, yeah, French people tend to be quite traditional and not early adopters. So even though there are startups in France, they might have to look for their early customers in the UK or the US, which is what we need.
Yes, but and we should point out that everything you do is in English, right? And this, yes. And all your stuff is aimed at global English speaking people. Do you think you'd be looking at foreign language stuff in the future? Because of course, we all want a translation marketplace.
You think I don't want that? Yeah, we're looking at that. I'm working on it.
That's good. Well, we'll hear about that another time. Okay, so today we're going to talk about some of the top mistakes that indie authors make, because you obviously deal with a lot of different authors at Readsy. So you actually see, and you're kind of above, above everyone. I mean, you have a bird's eye view. I think that's how we could put it. So I'm often blinded by my own artistic side, but you can see more. So let's start with, what is the number one problem that you see with authors, and perhaps the reason that many authors are so disappointed with publishing?
I think it have to do with really knowing what their goals are and what their definition of success is. So success can be many things, and obviously it evolves around time. I think your definition of success right now is different from back when you started indie publishing. But a lot of authors, when I ask them, ultimately they're working on their first book, and ask them, what do you want to do with it? Like, what's your ultimate goal? And they often say, I want to get it published. I don't know if with a publisher or myself, and I want to reach as many readers as possible. Well, it's not really a real goal or a definition of success, because that could be said from any author in the world. Any author wants to reach as many readers as possible. A definition of success would be becoming a professional author, so making a living out of writing, so quitting your day job and being able to sustain yourself only with your writing activities, which is what you've done. That can be a definition. Another definition can be plainly monetary. I want to make $1 million out of selling books. That can be another definition of success. But you need a clear goal in mind so that you can kind of draw a path toward that goal. I mean, it sounds very abstract like that, but I think it's really a mindset thing. And before even you take the plunge and decide to publish or make really any decisions with your book, you need to know where you want to go.
And actually, I think even further than that, it needs to be based on time period. So, for example, lots of authors end up making $1 million with their books, but for some people, it might take 30 years. And other people want to make, say, $1 million in a year. Now, you and I both know authors who do either of those things. So I think, and also making a living, it's very interesting. I think we've seen authors who make a living for 1 year and then they can't sustain that over time. So, you know, again, it might be, well, to actually consistently do this over time. So I think that's really important too. Okay, so the next issue, new authors often think that their book is for everybody. So why is that a problem and what should they be doing?
Yeah, I think that's the second main problem I encounter. So my first question usually is what do you want to do with your book? And then my second one is who's your book for? And similar to getting an answer, I want to reach as many people as I want, I get an answer, my book's for everybody. Or often I get, my book is, to be honest, probably for women. And I'm great, there's like 4 billion of those in the world, so it should be pretty easy to reach them. But that's, I mean, on the one hand, it's not realistic. So you're setting unrealistic expectations. So you're going to be disappointed. The same point as with the success thing. And on the other hand, when your book is, you finally publish your book and you want to start finding your first readers, if your first B readers can be anyone out of 4 billion people, it's going to be near to impossible to find that first reader. So there's like two problematics there with not having a very, very clear target audience. First one, you're setting unrealistic expectations. And then when time comes to market the book, you don't know where to start.
And do you think, like, I think demographics, so women aged 30 to 45, can sometimes be less helpful than psychographics, as in, like, you and I both read books for entrepreneurs, right? You know, we read, I don't know if you've read Angel by Jason Calacanis. Not read that one. But
not yet.
You know, that there are books that I know that you and I will read that, you know, other people who also read Stephen King might not read. So do you think that the psychographics there, like people who like this will like my book, is that more powerful?
I think it's a lot more powerful. I mean, demographics, I wouldn't pay that much attention to them because unless they really tie into the psychographics. But yeah, I think to define an audience, there's like a few things. There's Amazon categories. That's a way to define an audience. I write for people who read that category. It can work very well for like genre fiction niches, like historical romance or weird West, weird fantasy. Or by comparable titles or authors. I want my books for people who like Stephen King. I mean, even that's a bit broad because Stephen King writes a lot of different stuff, but my books for fans of the Dark Tower series, that's pretty specific. That's an interesting niche. So I think, yeah, these are two things, Amazon categories and comparable titles or authors. They're probably the best way to define who you want to write for.
And sort of, I guess also sort of going back to thinking about what Readsy does as well. So you have editors, you have cover designers, you have professionals who work with authors. So is it really important for the author to know that information before they try and find an editor or a cover designer?
I mean, for a cover designer, it's absolutely vital, I think, because you're at that stage where you want to give your book this, what's going to be like the first impression on the reader. And if you're aiming your book at a certain market, a certain niche, the cover needs to clearly identify the book as part of that niche. For an editor, it can be, it depends on the type of editing, of course. We do a lot of developmental editing, and at that stage, it's okay if you're not yet 100% sure who your niche is. Mm-hmm. Like you can say, it's YA fantasy, but I don't know if it's closer to that author or that author. Or if it's more urban, or the editor can help you with that. Can say, okay, it's, you've got more like the themes around that. You're writing similar to that author. Like you've got similar world building. So maybe try to emphasize that part of your writing or that part of your world, develop this character a bit more, and you'll get into that niche. And then maybe you pay attention to the, you do what they tell you to do, or you go another direction. But at the editorial stage, I think you've got more leeway, and you don't need to be absolutely certain what market you write for. At the design stage, you absolutely do, because otherwise you won't be able to guide your designer.
Yeah, exactly. Now, and it kind of leads on to onto the next thing, which is, you know, the word self-publishing is actually really wrong. And, you know, I don't know how we ended up with self-publishing, but, you know, both you and I know that doing it all yourself and, you know, just doing self-publishing you'll end up with a product that is not the best it can be. So, you know, why is trying to do it all yourself a mistake, even if, you know, you're struggling with a budget, for example?
Yeah, no, there's two sides to doing everything yourself. The first one is around quality of the product, as you mentioned. I think self-publishing, it's a bad term. We've been trying to use author publishing. Mm. A lot of us have tried. It didn't work. It didn't take. So we're stuck with self-publishing now. But a lot of professional people, a lot of professional circles around self-publishing, your podcast, our blog, we try to make it clear that there's a lot more than writing the book in the process. There's the editing, there's the design, there's the production, there's the marketing, and you cannot do everything yourself. Mm-hmm. And there's like specialties. Editing is a very specific, requires a very specific set of skills. Cover design is another yet completely different set of skills. And both are very different from writing. I mean, editing could seem similar to writing, but it's not. Mm. And design is obviously completely different. So while I think authors should do the lion's share of the marketing and really learn how to market, there's like nowhere around that right now. Editing and design, they shouldn't learn how to do it. They should trust other people to do that. And so that's for the quality part of the product. Then there's something I hear all the time from authors, even professional ones, is that they're overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. They don't have time for anything. I hear them at conferences, they're tired. They don't even go at the bar at night to get a drink because they're too tired. I mean, it's a shame, really. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when you reach a point that you're selling well, you're having a good career, maybe you're making a living out of writing, but you're taking on too many things at the same time, because obviously the more money you make, or the more successful you are, the more responsibilities you end up having. And so at some point comes a time to probably hire a virtual assistant, which we don't have on Reetsy, by the way. I'm not encouraging people to hire virtual assistants on Reetsy. We don't have them. But if you're getting to that point where you feel you're successful, you've got good editors, good designers, a good process in place, but you have too much stuff on your plate, start thinking about what you can outsource. Because otherwise, you're just going to burn yourself out. And maybe that's why some authors, one year, they're making a living out of writing, and then the next year, they can't anymore because they've got too much stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. And it's hard in one show to kind of aim at people just starting and people a lot further down the track. But, you know, as someone who is further down the track, you know, this is year six for me full time. And it is, you know, and even just like last week, I was saying yet again, you know, I need to stop doing everything. I need to. And I don't, I mean, I have a team, but yeah. I still feel like I'm overwhelmed. So I think you're right. It's a case of when you're just starting out, you need to improve and you need to have a quality product. And then and it's about reinvesting the money into your business as well. I think that's really important. And although I would say on the budget, you know, when I was starting out, I just used money from my day job to pay my editor. Like you don't, or save it up or use it, you know, whatever you would have spent on your hobby. So I'm not suggesting that people do like a Kickstarter for their first novel, which I've seen, which I think is crazy, right?
It is. For a novel, it is. We're encouraging it for illustrated books because illustrated stuff works really well on Kickstarter. Or if you've got a multimedia project, if it ties into video games. For children's books as well, we encourage it sometimes because that, if there's merchandising involved as well, it can work. Mm. And we've got ties with Kickstarter. I'm doing a webinar with them in a couple of weeks. So some things can work there, but a novel is just not exciting enough, sadly, when it's pitched there on Kickstarter, because you don't have visuals. It's not, unless you've got a huge following already, but if that's the case, you should be able to monetize it through books and not through Kickstarter campaigns.
Yeah, exactly. So yes, saving it up at the beginning and then reinvesting profits to grow your backlist over time. And I did want to ask that again, sort of on the money side and the risk. So one of the reasons people hesitate around editors and cover designers, I think editors particularly, because a cover design is quite obvious. It's like, here's what it looks like, you know, whereas editing can feel, it's a more difficult thing. So how, and you, Reedy vets editors.
Yeah.
So there's a quality there, but what are the best ways for people to really find the right editor for them?
It's a complicated question. First, I think you need to reach out to several editors, because if you find one that's recommended by an author friend of yours, it's great. But you want several opinions so that you can compare, because oftentimes the first feedback you get on your manuscript, even if it's on the first few pages from an editor, if it's the first time ever you work with an editor, you're going to be impressed. Even if it's like a relatively good, not an amazing editor, relatively good one. The first one I had a blog post edited by an editor, I was amazed. I'm like, wow, I didn't know I my English was that bad and this blog post could be so much better, you know? So most of the case, you're going to be impressed. But you could have been impressed even more by another editor. So what I recommend, if it's your first time, reach out to several editors and they should automatically give you their first opinion of your book based on your description. And generally, they're always going to read your first chapter or your first few pages to get a feel of your writing and how much work it's going to be for them to work on your book. So they can give you a quote, they're going to do that. And then they're going to give you their first impression. So I think your voice is like this. I think from the first few pages, you start writing the novel in the wrong place, or I think you can improve on this and that. And then have a conversation with them. You can ask them for a sample edit if you want, or if the really, really good editors won't provide one. So what you can ask is for a sample edit or an edit letter that they've done on a previous manuscript, typically. Because if it's for an editorial assessment or developmental edit that really looks at the whole book, it's hard to say, give me a sample on the first chapter, because they had need to have a bird's eye view of the manuscript. But you can ask them for an edit letter that they wrote on another author's manuscript to see what kind of things they address in an editorial assessment or in a developmental edit. Get samples. If it's not on your own manuscript, on another author's manuscript, they'll be able to provide that. And then compare, see what style you prefer. Some editors are very tough love kind of style. Some others are a lot milder. They're going to say the same things, but maybe in a nicer tone. It depends what you want from the editor. Usually the way we see it on Reedsy, when authors reach out to 4 or 5, they really end up going for the lowest quote. So it's not a question of pricing. When you find an editor who resonates with you, you're going to go with them because they resonate with you, not because you're cheaper than the others.
I think that's really important. And also, I think it's a bit like dating, in that, you know, you might not find the right person the first time. And also you change over time as you become a better writer. You know, you may change editors as your style develops and as your voice develops. And also as you become more confident as a writer, you kind of want different things from an editor. So these things change over time. But just on, because obviously you're not having the editors on Reedsy work on all your stuff in order to vet them. So how are you vetting people who come onto the Reedsy marketplace?
So we look at the resume. We look at all the books they've worked on in the past. We check if they're mentioned in the acknowledgements, just to make sure that they've worked on the books that they say they've worked on. We take a look at how the books are doing on Amazon. A lot of the editors on our marketplace have worked for traditional publishers in the past. So we make sure of that. We make sure that the books in their portfolio have been published by the publishers that they said they worked for. So that, like, yeah, everything makes sense. And then a lot of work that we do is to make sure that the genres they list on their profile match the books in their portfolio. So that if you look for a fancy editor on Reedsy, you're going to find editors who worked on The Martians, who've worked with Brandon Sanderson, who've worked with indie fancy authors, so that it's really relevant. And we've gotten to that point where searches on Reedsy are really relevant. So you're going to find editors you're probably going to be impressed with.
Mm, Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And the reason I support Readsy and recommend it is because of the vetting. Because and this is, I think, where we are now in the indie space. On the one hand, we have this broad church, which is, yay, anyone can be indie, go forth and just do your thing. And then, you know, but there are a subgroup who want to do things in a professional way. And, you know, recommending services is really important that they are good services. So I appreciate you vetting people.
No, and we provide an additional kind of safety net behind that. If you're not happy with the editor, if the editor's at fault, we take a look into it. Like, there's a mediation process. We very, very rarely have to get involved. And when we have to, we just like take a look at it and mediate. To be honest, more often than not, it's more on the author's fault than the editor's.
Yeah.
But when it was on the editor's, I mean, the author got a refund and was able to find someone else. And so there's additional safety net that's part of Readsy. But I think the curation we do on the editor's side means that we almost never have to get involved. I mean, author's feedback are always... I think average rating of Readsy is 9.3 out of 10 or 9.4. So people seem to be happy.
No, it's great. Okay, so that's coming back to mistakes. So there are a lot of publishing options, and in fact, more and more publishing options every day now, which is kind of crazy. So what mistakes are authors making when they actually publish?
I think they don't do their research on publishing options, basically. I've got a lot of authors who come to me and tell me, so I've got this book idea I'm writing in, I'm going to publish with Nook. And I said, that's great, but why are you going to publish with Nook? Like, it's going to be available on Barnes & Noble. Have you heard of Amazon? Typically. But that's not the worst case scenario. The other case is like I publish with Ex Libris or Author House or whatever vanity publisher is actually going to take a fee for publishing, distributing books or something that's free. So that's, I mean, that mistake is just falling for the scams or not doing their research. There are also people who do a print run instead of doing print on demand. You did that, right?
Oh, yeah, like way back in the day, 2007, yeah, doing a print run, yeah, before print on demand was like really in zone.
Exactly. So you end up with like 2,000 books in your garage and you don't know how to sell them. So it's question of doing research, same as you need to do research on editing and on design. Like, we can help with that. We don't help on the distribution side of things because there are lots of players doing it really, really well. Like, I'm a big fan of Draft to Digital typically for everything that's not uploading ebooks to Amazon. Then for print on demand, there's CreateBiz, CreateSpace, AngularSpark. So I think reaching out to people like you, reaching out to people like us, reading blog posts from trusted sources, doing research basically on publishing distribution options will go a long way and will avoid very costly mistakes, very costly mistakes.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And the sort of, yeah, the trusted voices is interesting because I've been thinking about this recently because, you know, and sometimes it's about who you resonate with. You know, I know that the people listening to this show resonate with me, and I'm not a very hypey, not very American, you know, type of thing. But some people prefer that approach. And again, you're European, so we have a slightly more muted sense. But the trusted voices, how do you recommend people find voices to trust in the space?
That's a tough one because I've got my trusted sources that I recommend to to authors. I'd say, I mean, the Alliance of Independent Authors is a great place to start looking because they've got a services directory that they vet, and they have a watchdog service that looks for scams and other things like that. So if you come across a service or someone who claims they'll do amazing things for you, check on the Alliance of Independent Authors blog. So that's selfpublishingadvice.org. If they're mentioned on that blog, obviously check on your blog if they're mentioned there, or there's David Goffrin as well, who does an amazing job at as a watchdog. So check on watchdog places, Writers Beware as well from Victoria Strauss. And I mean, other than that, just Google reviews of services, just as you would do for any kind of other business. Check Google the name of the business, then reviews, and see what people are saying about them. So I think, yeah, it's doing research. It's not believing what people tell you if it's the first time you hear about them, just like double checking what other people have to say about this person. And all the trusted sources I know in this industry, including you, including hopefully our blog, I haven't seen anything bad mentioned about them anywhere else. So if you've come across a trusted source and you do a bit of research and you try to see if it's a scam or not, if it's actually a trusted source, you'll immediately know, because publishing industry, people are very nice. That's why I love this industry. So we're not going to say bad stuff about a website or a person that's doing good things.
And in fact, I think it is so nice that a lot of the times people won't mention the bad stuff. So you're not actually going to find information about bad things on my site because I don't mention them.
Exactly.
It's a bit like with Goodreads. I only give books 4 or 5 stars on Goodreads because I would never do a bad thing. But yeah, I think David Cochrane is a really good one. But also I think it's the length of time in the market. This is something else. And I'm kind of understanding now why Google gives more page rank to older websites. Yes. Because if you've been around as long, you know, my website was started in 2008, and the Alliance has been going 5 years now. And I think you probably remember when we first met, I was like, oh yeah, hi, whatever. And I think it was probably 2 years until after you'd been around at events and we'd met at London Book Fair a number of times. And I was like, oh, hey, you know, Reedsy, these guys they're not going away. And that is a really big deal, I think, because so many of the services are kind of, or things change, like a pronoun, to mention one, it's I remember when they were Vuk back in 2009, they've changed their business model so many times that it kind of makes me go, what is going on there? You know, the kind of that change. So is longevity part of the thing as well?
I think it is. Google rewards longevity, but I mean, you've got semi-shady businesses that have been going on a long time as well. I mean, I mentioned Lulu. Lulu's not shady, but they do have overpriced services, in my humble opinion. And they're number one for self-publishing, if you Google self-publishing, I think, or they're right up there because they've been going a long time and because they're international. So don't trust Google, but trust the websites that are really specific to self-publishing that have been going around for some time. One last thing. So I mentioned David Cochrane. Sorry for the wind. Keyboards is also a really good place to look at. The Writer's Cafe Forum on Keyboards, with every bad service, it will get flagged there. And it's got a very critical crowd. So you'll hear, if there's something bad to be said about a service, you'll see it on there.
And although you can get lost in keywords, I try not to go there because we just end up. But no, it is when you're checking services out, or yeah, that's really good. Okay, so I guess last sort of big mistake around marketing. What is the biggest thing that you see authors getting wrong with marketing?
So last thing is, it goes back to authors being overwhelmed. It's authors trying to do everything. And that's like specific to, marketing the book. It's often authors will tell me, I don't get it. I'm on Twitter. I tweet 5 times a day. I have a blog. I've got a Facebook page. I've tried Facebook ads, but it didn't work. I'm doing all that and still I'm not selling anything. And they're spending maybe 3-4 hours on marketing their book every day with absolutely no results. And that happens quite often. It's often among older demographics of authors who are not familiar with social media and things like that. And there's so much bad advice out there about marketing, especially around social media. Like, you need to be on Twitter. You need to have a Facebook page. You need to this. You need to that. Everyone who writes a blog post with a piece of marketing advice will start it or have at some point, you need to in there. And the truth is, there's nothing you need to do. That's like first rule of marketing for startups or for companies. There's nothing you need to do. There are things you need to test. probably. Like Facebook ads is probably something you need to test. Amazon ads is probably something you need to test. If it doesn't work out after you've tested it properly, then don't do it. If you're on Twitter, you have 30,000 followers on Twitter because you've been, I don't know, been really good, but it doesn't bring any sales and it takes 2 hours of your time every day, maybe like spend less time on it or stop tweeting altogether. There's nothing that you need to do except testing new techniques when you hear about them, and then measuring the results of those. Amazon ads are great because they're very easy to measure. Like it's right there in your dashboard, average cost of sale. Facebook ads are a bit trickier, but still you're able to see whether they're working or not. In general, advertising online, it's very easy to track. Mm. Other things are harder. But generally, when you spend a lot of time on something and it doesn't seem to be producing results, you need to not be afraid to just drop it. And I think that's something authors are really afraid of because they're thinking, I need to market my book. But if you're not selling, then you're effectively not marketing. Even if you spend 5 hours a day on it, it's not marketing.
Mm, absolutely. So, well, then out of interest, what are some of the things that you guys have stopped doing at Reedsy? Or how have you pivoted for your own marketing? Because you're marketing your brand a lot, aren't you? Or what works, what hasn't worked for you guys?
That's a good question. We've done a lot of Hangouts interviews like that. Haven't worked so well because you need to spend a lot of time on it, I think, and really focus on it. A bit like you did. And we didn't have we couldn't focus just on that. I think in the beginning, we tested Facebook ads for promoting content and getting clicks on our website. Mm. And that didn't work. And now we're spending quite a bit on Facebook ads, but for other stuff, for lead gen ads and for promoting our free online courses. Mm. And that works. What we spend the most time and resources on is content and education for authors. Mm. And we tie that into SEO. At the beginning, our blog had no traffic at all. And now it has quite a bit of traffic thanks to SEO. So at some point, we're thinking, why do we write 2 blog posts a week when very few people read them and there's very low traffic on our blog and it hasn't improved? So what do we need to change? So we started looking into SEO and we were started producing content that would answer Google queries. And that gave us traffic to our blog and supported our other blog posts that are not necessarily just there to answer Google queries. Mm. So yeah, it's constantly kind of reevaluating what you're doing in terms of marketing and seeing what's really moving the needle or not. Some things take another. Well, I think the most dangerous marketing activity is the one that takes you a lot of time and produces just a little bit of results.
Yes.
Like just enough to let you think that you need to keep going doing it because it provides you maybe 5% of your income, but takes, I don't know, 50% of your time. So I don't really want to lose 5% of my income. But then it's almost certain that if you drop that and liberate 50% of your time, you'll come up with other techniques or other things that will be a lot more profitable marketing-wise.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I actually think Amazon ads for me is kind of in that bracket because it's like, it is a tiny little lift, but you know, for me, it barely outweighs the effort, you know, and whereas, because I sell in other ways, like through the podcast and things that I can't directly measure, I can't measure somebody listening right now who might decide to go check me out on Amazon and might decide to buy a book. So it is very hard to figure out these things, but I like what you're saying, like evaluating, you know, what's worth doing and what isn't. So just on that, you know, because you're an entrepreneur and you're used to things like pivoting and changing direction and things like that. So are there any sort of mindset shifts that you've had to go through as an entrepreneur in your journey that might help other people?
Other authors or other people in general?
Author entrepreneurs, like authors
who entrepreneurs. Are
I'd
say thinking of yourself as a business, Because at this time, think of yourself as a business and your books as products. Because from the time you publish a book and start selling it online or even offline, you are effectively a business. You're selling a product. Mm. And if you start thinking in that way, you'd have the right mindset, then you need to learn about actually how do you set up a business. There's a lot of administrative things, a lot of other more mindset related things. So you start reading books about how to set up a business, about how to run a business, start reading about how to market a product, how to market a product online, how to market products on Amazon. Marketing a book on Amazon is not necessarily that different from marketing other types of products on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So maybe reading about just like Amazon algorithms in general, not only related to books, will be helpful. Actually, maybe you'll foresee what kind of advertising opportunities will arise in the future for authors by taking a look at what's available to other people, to other vendors on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Like authors have very, very little opportunities to advertise. Like the advertising is very narrow. Publishers have a bit more and other vendors have a lot more. Start thinking of yourself as a business, your books or products. Do research that does not just like author oriented. If you want to learn about Facebook ads, there's Mark Dosen, but there's also John Loomer. John Loomer is like more general Facebook ads, but again, he'll spot new things probably even quicker than Mark Dosen. And I love Mark and he's doing a great job. But like I'm saying, read John Loomer as well, read his blog. So even if it's not 100% related to authorship, to books, then read general things. And finally, there's a big thing when it comes to marketing, and it's really mindset, is think from a reader perspective. Instead of how am I going to sell this book, how can a reader find about my book, and how are the readers I want to reach going to learn that I exist and that I have books that they're probably going to enjoy? And as soon as you start thinking from a reader's perspective, I think a lot of things become clearer in marketing the book and where you need to place it, and on your marketing activities as well. I mean, that's the whole idea behind Nick Stevenson's course and blog on author marketing and reader magnets. Even it's shifting the mindset from I want to sell a book to how are people going to find out about my book?
And then I did want to just ask you about starting out as well. Again, kind of winding back time to when I first met you. You didn't just go, oh, we'll start a company called Readzy and we'll immediately make lots of money and, you know, it's going to be great. I remember it being hard for you at the beginning. So tell us a bit about that journey. Like how long did it take from when you started the business to when you went, okay, this is actually going to work?
That's the thing. It's a bit different when you're a startup because you go all in. Like we quit our day job, we quit everything. So you have to believe that it's going to work. Otherwise, you're certain it's not going to work. For authors, it's a bit different. I encourage everyone to keep their day job and start ramping up things slowly. But I think you really got to believe, even if you do that, you got to believe that it's going to work and that you're going to achieve whatever your definition of success is. Of course, you need to have a proper plan for it. The moment when we really realized we're going to make it, I mean, we still don't know if we're going to make it. We're profitable, so we're a good company. We're not going to die, basically. And we know that, we've been doing that for probably a little less than a year. But I think what I really enjoy and what I really feel that we've become, I'd say, successful is when I go around at conferences or I talk to other authors and I'm like, I've heard about you guys. You do great stuff. Mm. And the less often I have to explain to people professional authors, what Readzy is, the happier I am. Because it means that we've achieved, we're known everywhere. And if people need our services and they're going to come to us, if they don't, they won't. But at least they know about us. So kind of, my job is done.
No, that's great. And I think you're right. It's that, but I mean, that's kind of what all authors are aiming for too, is like, most people have never heard of most authors, including like Lee Child, or like there's only 3 famous authors in the world, J.K. Rowling, Stephen King, when James Patterson probably.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, who were alive anyway. But no, that's great. And building our brand is so important. Okay, so tell us then, what does Readsy offer in terms of the various services and education?
Yeah, so the core of Readsy and what's always been our idea and will remain always central to our business is, as you said, a vetted marketplace of editorial design, marketing, publicity, ghostwriting, and hopefully soon translation talent. And that means we get around 200 applications from freelancers every week who want to be listed on our marketplace because they know they're going to get work on it. And we accept around 3% of those. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very highly curated. And you know, you're only getting people who worked with traditional publishers in the past or with best-selling authors who we've verified, and on top of that, we provide a safety net. So we're actually taking a very strong financial interest in those people being good. Then we've built a lot of collaboration tools around that. So actually, I think working with an editor or a designer on Readsy is probably easier than via email because you've got a collaboration dashboard. You can share files, messages, everything stays in one place. Payments are automated, receipts, invoices, VAT, everything is there. So it makes it really easy to kind of build a freelance team around your writing business and keep it on there. And that's why a lot of publishers actually use this as well, because it kind of streamlines their production workflow and helps them keep all the finances in one place for freelancers. Then we've got a free formatting tool called the Readsy Book Editor, which is similar to Vellum, for those of you familiar with Vellum, except it's free. It's browser-based, so you can access it from any device, computer, laptop, tablet, iPhone, Android. And it has less customization possibilities than Vellum. To be perfectly honest. However, it exports to both ebook formats and print-on-demand formats. So you can choose your trim size, a bunch of other options, and export your books. So the best advice is take a look at it. It's free, and it works really, really well. We keep building it up to add more customization possibilities. But for those of you who haven't purchased Vellum or hesitating, take a look at our Readsy Book Editor. If it meets your requirements, that is probably a good option. And finally, we've got what we call Readsy Learning, which is something we launched in October last year. And it's kind of a way for me to do less customer service. It's a bunch of free online courses on various topics. So I wrote one on Book Marketing 101, in which I go through the different mistakes we mentioned today, plus other tips. Yeah. I wrote one on Facebook advertising for authors as well. So not trying to compete with Mark Dawson. It's a very, very light course. They're more there to get you interested about a topic and give you enough to get started, basically. I've got one on Amazon ads as well, because I've run a few campaigns for other authors that have worked out all right, not amazing. But Amazon ads are pretty simple, so I know how they work and I can describe that. And then we've got courses by professionals on our marketplace. We've got a UK editor of the Martian who's writing something on fantasy right now. I've got a literary agent who's writing something on word building. Got a great course on dialogue. We've got a course on short stories. A bunch of craft topics like that, publishing, marketing. And audiobooks as well. So if you Google Readsy Learning, you'll come across them. The concept's very simple. You get an email a day for 10 days in the morning. It's a very short read. It's like ideal over coffee. Have a cup of coffee every morning. You learn about something new every morning for 5 minutes. And yeah, that way I can point people to the courses instead of writing again 10 times, you should know what your definition of success is. You shouldn't write for everyone, things like that.
Yeah, and that's why I have an autoresponder series as well, which is fun with my blueprint. And we are saying the same things. I think this is really important. And, you know, I know that your ethos is similar to mine, almost exactly the same as mine, to be fair. Yeah. And that's really great. And it's great having a different voice in the space who believes the same thing. And, you know, you and I both believe in this as a movement as well as a business. So definitely. I think that's really important. So where can people find Readsy online?
So they can find Readsy simply at readsy.com, but you've also got a special link that will give you $20 credit if you use thecreativepen.com/readsy. So that's a special link that you can thank Joanna for. So thecreativepen.com/readsy, R-E-E-D-S-Y, and that will take you to a special page that will tell you that if you sign up there, you'll get $20 of credits that will go towards your first Readsy collaboration, whether it's an editor, designer, marketer, ghostwriter.
Fantastic.
Hopefully you won't
need a ghostwriter. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Ricardo. That's been absolutely fantastic. Can people find you on Twitter as well?
Yeah, at Ricardo Fayette, all together.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time. That was great.
No, thank you so much for inviting me.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Ricardo today, and you can check out the Readsy editor for book formatting, as well as lists of book promotion sites and the vetted professionals. If you need an editor or cover designer, you can go to thecreativepen.com/Readsy, R-E-E-D-S-Y. And next week, I'm talking to the lovely Anna McNuff, who has been named by Condé Nast Traveler as one of the 50 most influential travelers of our time, and by The Guardian UK as one of the top modern female adventurers. We'll be talking about her new book on running across New Zealand, and also how to write travel memoir, as well as tackling your fears, and of course whether writing a book was just as hard as running like 4,000 kilometres. So it's a super fun interview, and Anna is brilliant, so I know you'll enjoy it. So look forward to that next week, and happy writing. I will see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.